You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny, and I am in the corner of the Reading Envy pub with a new guest to the Reading Envy podcast, but not a new guest to podcast, Thomas Otto. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you. Hello, everybody.
So happy to have you here. So some of you might recognize Thomas's voice because he is a regular, a co-host, I guess, on the Readers podcast.
I am. I think it's been over 2 years now. It doesn't seem like it's been that long, but because I think we're in the 160s now for episodes, and I think I started in the 80s. So
do you guys do every 2 weeks? I mean, when you're on a regular schedule.
Yeah, when we're on a regular schedule, it's every 2 weeks. But there are always some, as you probably know, blips that make that hard to do.
Yeah, it can be hard. And so some people probably know you and what kind of books you like to read, but not everyone will. So can you tell us a little bit about what kind of reader you are?
There's two different ways to answer that. One is, like, how do I actually read? And I will say that I am a fast and not a close reader, which was why getting ready to record with you, I thought, man, I have to actually pay attention because my husband always accuses me that I don't actually read my books because, like, 2 days later, I couldn't tell you a thing about it. Although that's changed because now on my blog, one of the reasons I try and write something about every book I read is so that I just remember. It's my online filing system for what I've read, or else I can't remember anything. I envy people who can remember characters and plots and all that kind of stuff, but that's not me. So that's the first thing. And then these days, so I'm 47 now, going on 48 this summer, and my reading tastes have morphed as everyone's do, but mine, I have less and less time for serious books. And I don't mean serious content. I mean books like with air quote serious around them. And sometimes that can come off, I think, to some as anti-intellectual, which I kind of am, but not really. So I do like a lot of kind of readable books, if you will. And I know some people would even take offense by that. But I prefer female characters. I prefer female authors. Although I'm always surprised at the end of the year when my mix is actually pretty much half and half. I'm a little surprised sometimes about how many men I read. And I do like things that are turn of the century to like mid to about 1950, 1960. Anything that kind of takes me back to the old days, and they don't have to be that old for me to enjoy that.
Than your days.
Yeah. Although, you know what? I read some book recently, reread a book that took place in the late 80s, early 90s. And it was just different enough that I'm like, oh God, I remember that. I think because one of the characters went to a travel agency and had a paper airplane ticket. And so anyway, so yeah, I can get pretty nostalgic pretty fast. But one caveat about that is I tend not to like historical fiction because a lot of what I've read, they try too hard to get the historical details and it's just too obvious. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like reading the contemporary accounts more than someone who's writing in retrospect. But as far as authors go, I like some of my favorites are Anita Bruckner and Barbara Pym. I used to say Margaret Atwood, but I'm less of a Margaret Atwood fan, although some of her stuff is absolutely brilliant. As far as dystopia goes, of course, The Handmaid's Tale is brilliant.
Amazing.
But I really, more than anything, have now my absolute favorite Atwood is her Mad Atom trilogy. I've read them twice, and the second time was even better than the first time. I just think they're brilliant. The way that I read them was, of course, I read them when they came out, and then when the third one came out, I started over, and it was so amazing to, even though I had read them before, it was to finish the first one and then think, wait a minute, I don't have to wait for the next one. There it is.
Yeah.
And then I finished that one and there's the third one. So that was a lot of fun.
And I think what I love about those compared to The Handmaid's Tale is The Handmaid's Tale is, you know, spot on and terrifying, but it's all terrifying. You know, it's all sad and disturbing and dark. And especially the second book of that trilogy, The Year of the Flood, has so much humor in it that I was just laughing all the time, especially as the songs get darker and darker and God's gardeners get more and more desperate. I thought it was hilarious.
Well, and I think there's also hope in the Mad Atom trilogy, even though the planet's more or less been not destroyed, but altered greatly.
So you like Anita Bruckner and Barbara Pym. Those are your favorites, you think?
Well, I do, I think. It makes me look like a very narrow reader because that doesn't represent a very broad field of content or author experience. You know, they're not terribly dissimilar, although Pym has a sense of humor. Well, I mean, Bruckner does too, but it's harder to find. And I'm, of course, I'm blanking on every other fabulous author that I love, but those will come out. Those will come out.
Well, I think we're each going to talk about some books we've read and liked recently. Did you want to start?
Sure, I will.
Okay.
And actually, I will start with another favorite author and another female. I'm going to start with The Song of the Lark by Willa Cather.
Excellent.
And the thing about Willa Cather, have you read any Cather?
I have.
Well, so Cather is someone that, you know, she's considered to be an important author of the 20th century. And she should be, I still think that she's underrated and underread. But I think the one thing people know about Cather, if they haven't read her, is that she is one of those important authors. And I think some people shy away from that and think that there's going to be something difficult or not enjoyable about them. But Cather is immensely enjoyable to read. And the first time I read her, I was in grad school the first time. And so I had been doing all sorts of course reading for the school year. And the first thing I did when the school year ended is I went to the big downtown library that I lived near and just thought, all right, I'm going to start attacking some, you know, important books that I haven't read. And Cather was one of the first that I pulled off the shelves. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is delightful. Why have I waited until I was, 26 at the time?
So you never had to read her in school?
No, never.
Okay. Because I read Antonia in school.
Yeah. No, my high school was a very poor showing for literature. I read very little in high school. I mean, for class.
Before you talk about The Song of the Lark, I'll say that the book I read, I believe, is because of you, but I might have this wrong. The Professor's House?
Yes.
Was that what you picked for Booktopia? Or?
Yeah, I did. I picked that for Booktopia. So, and what was your thoughts on The Professor's House?
Oh, I loved it. And it made me realize there's all these books by her I've never even heard of. I didn't have a name association with them or anything. Yeah. So I'd love to hear about Song of Larks. I don't know that one.
Well, and so she did write 12 novels, and I've read, I think, all but one of them. And this year I'm rereading all of them in chronological order.
Wow.
It was so one a month. And so this was the second one. It's her second it's her third, I'm sorry. And it's her third novel. It was published in 1915. But she wrote three that are kind of referred to as the Great Plains novels. Mm-hmm. And the first one was O Pioneers, which was her second book. And then the second one was this one, The Song of the Lark. And then the third one is her next published novel, and that is My Antonia. So they each kind of... Well, I don't remember where My Antonia takes place specifically, but O Pioneers is in Nebraska. And this one, Song of the Lark, takes place in Colorado, but it's a very, you know, obviously Nebraska borders Colorado. Mm-hmm. And so it's a similar kind of atmosphere, though slightly different geography. And also another kind of tale of the pioneers, really, the people who settled the plains and kind of what those early years were like. Not necessarily early years, but, you know, when they were still kind of forming their own identities and kind of taming what was there, getting used to it or being able to make a living off of it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because she actually was born in Western Virginia, like almost on the border of West Virginia. But when she was about six, they moved out to Red Cloud, Nebraska. In one of her later books, I think maybe even her last book, takes her back to where she was born, which and it's called the Sapphira and the Slave Girl. But she is very much acquainted or associated with the plains and Nebraska specifically. And I grew up in Minnesota, which is not too far from Nebraska. And definitely I had experiences both in Minnesota and in North Dakota visiting friends and relatives that, for me, there's a lot of deep associations with some of the stuff she talks about. Mm. So The Song of the Lark, like I said, is one of the Great Plains novels, but it kind of takes off from there because the main character, Thea Kronborg, she is a bit of a musical prodigy, at least for her small town. She's got some talent playing the piano, but she goes off to Chicago to study. And, you know, so this was published in 1950, and you can imagine a 17-year-old girl going from a small town in Colorado to Chicago to take piano lessons. And so she does and discovers there that others point out to her that her singing voice is as good, if not better, than her piano skills. And so she starts to take voice lessons and shows a lot of promise. And long story short, she ends up being famous and you know, becomes a diva, really, an opera diva. Maybe not in the strict sense of what we think of a diva, but she becomes an opera singer. And so the book really is kind of her conflict with her kind of simple small town upbringing and then everything she encounters in the city in Chicago. And then she kind of makes her career at first in Germany, which is offstage. We don't actually see that in the novel. And then the novel ends with her being in New York. So she kind of leaves the plains behind, which is interesting because then the third Great Plains novel, I think, is strictly back on the plains in My Antonia. But it's interesting on this one how Cather takes us out of that, out of the Midwest or the Plains states. And I should say, actually, her first novel, Alexander's Bridge, that one took place on the East Coast. The character was from Michigan, I think. So still kind of, you know, Midwestish. But she started off, you know, writing about that in the East. So it's not an epic, but there are things that happen along the way that are like almost like mini novels in themselves, where characters who are important, who are, you know, their storyline kind of climaxes and then dims down while she kind of continues on. And then there are kind of those little mini climaxes along the way, the ins and outs of all the people in her life, I guess. For me, one of the most striking things in the book is when she goes off to the Southwest. She goes to a ranch in Arizona to kind of, she's been studying for a while in Chicago and she's really losing heart and feeling like it's maybe not right for her and thinking about going home. And kind of one of her patrons says, "Oh, I have a ranch out in Arizona. Why don't you go and rest there for a while?" So she does. And it's the first of Cather's novels where she takes us to the Southwest.
I was going
to
say that sounds really familiar.
Yes.
That's what happens in the professor's house too, right?
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. And she also does it in Death Comes for the Archbishop, I think is entirely set in the Southwest.
Yeah.
And there may be another one too. And it's really kind of interesting because, you know, if you think about Southwest around the turn of the century, female artists, of course, I start to think of, my mind was blanking. And so in my head, I almost feel like they're the same spirits, kind of, because roughly the same time period, you know, kind of independent women artists who did really amazing things, and they both have this affinity for the Southwest. I have no idea if there's any connection whatsoever between them,
yeah,
or if they were even aware of each other. But in my head, I kind of conflate the two. So anyway, in this book, Thea goes out to Arizona to kind of recoup and recharge. The way that Cather writes about the Southwest, I find it so enchanting and spiritual. And I'm not a really spiritual person. Most of my thoughts related to that are kind of nature oriented. And there's just something about her, the way she writes about the Southwest, that just makes me, it just makes me happy and calm and just, if it just makes me think of simpler kind of times, if you will, which of course is not always true, but there's just something about it that I find really evocative and pleasing. Hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why I love The Professor's House so much, is for that middle part of the book that takes place in the Southwest. But at any rate, so Thea's out there, and each day she kind of goes out into one of the canyons. So it's this area where these kind of flat tablelands, and then there are these canyons that you kind of come up to them without really knowing that they're there. So if you weren't paying attention, you could potentially, you know, be walking along and fall off one of them. it's down in these canyons where there are cliff dwellings, where Native Americans would have lived. And years ago, I was in the Gila National Forest in New Mexico, near Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I got to see some of these cliff dwellings. And it was a very quiet Sunday morning in February. And maybe as I read her, I think back to that experience. You know, it was it wasn't heavily touristed because it was Sunday morning, because it was February. And so I felt like I had this place to myself, this ancient dwelling. Anyway, so I would like to read a little bit of it that kind of takes place there and kind of sets it up. So in the book, this is really where she's at a point where she's not sure what to do, whether she should kind of go back to her old life or kind of move on to greater things. Because I should mention that part of the idea of her going to Chicago was that she would get training, and then she would essentially go back to her hometown of Moonstone, Colorado, and kind of become, you know, the music teacher, not in a school, but kind of giving private lessons, which she had done before she left. But then she would kind of have the credentials to really kind of own that kind of business in her hometown. And so she's definitely, she's kind of at a crossroads here. The faculty of observation was never highly developed in Thea Kronborg. A great deal escaped her eye as she passed through the world. But the things which were for her, she saw. She experienced them physically and remembered them as if they had once been a part of herself. The roses she used to see in the florist shops in Chicago were merely roses. But when she thought of the moonflowers that grew over Mrs. Telemontez's door, it was as if she had been that vine and had opened in the white flowery in white flowers every night. There were memories of light on the sand hills, of masses of prickly pear blossoms she had found in the desert in early childhood, of the late afternoon sun pouring through the grape leaves and the mint bed in Mrs. Kohler's garden, which she would never lose. These recollections were part of her mind and personality. In Chicago, she had got almost nothing that went into her subconscious self and took root there. But here, in Panther Canyon, there were again things which seemed destined for her. Panther Canyon was the home of innumerable swallows. They built nests in the wall far above the hollow groove in which Thea's own rock chamber lay. They seldom ventured above the rim of the canyon to the flat, windswept tableland. Their world was the blue air river between the canyon walls. In that blue gulf, the arrow-shaped birds swam all day long, with only an occasional movement of the wings. The only sad thing about them was their timidity, the way in which they lived their lives between the echoing cliffs and never dared to rise out of the shadow of the canyon walls. As they swam past her door, Thea often felt how easy it would be to dream one's life out in some cleft in the world. And then a little later in that same chapter, she's going through her day, but when she goes into these cliff dwellings, there are leftover shards of pottery and other effects from these indigenous tribes. And the thing she notes in the book, also in somewhere near here, she talks about how the people who had lived there had been gone for probably a couple hundred of years before the Spaniards got to Arizona. And I looked it up. So the Spaniards arrived there in 1539. So if you think about these people who had lived there maybe 200 years before that, and for how many decades or hundreds of years they may have lived there, it takes you so far back. And if you also think that Catherine was writing this in 1915 and how kind of quiet and simple the world was then, and yet she's looking that much further back, it's just it's chilling, I think. But anyway, so she's kind of talking about her day and the pottery that she comes across. When Thea took her bath at the bottom of the canyon in the sunny pool behind the screen of cottonwoods, she sometimes felt as if the water must have sovereign qualities from having been the object of so much service and desire. That stream was the only living thing left of the drama that had been played out in the canyon centuries ago. in the rapid, restless heart of it, flowing swifter than the rest, there was a continuity of life that reached back into the old time. The glittering thread of current had a kind of lightly worn, loosely knit personality, graceful and laughing. Thea's bath came to have a ceremonial gravity. The atmosphere of the canyon was ritualistic. One morning, as she was standing upright in the pool, splashing water between her shoulder blades with a big sponge, something flashed through her mind that made her draw herself up and stand still until the water had quite dried upon her flushed skin. The stream and the broken pottery. What was any art but an effort to make a sheath, a mold in which to imprison for a moment the shining, elusive element which is life itself? Life hurrying past us and running away, too strong to stop, too sweet to lose. And then she kind of goes on to talk about the pottery and how, and she kind of starts to make connections between her own art and their art and how they did this for no reason. You know, they lived a subsistence life, yet they still had art in their lives, and that was important to them. And so she says here, some of them were beautifully decorated. This care expended upon vessels that could not hold food or water any better for the additional labor put upon them made her heart go out to those ancient potters. They had not only expressed their desire, but they had expressed it as beautifully as they could. Food, fire, water, and something else. Even here in this crack in the world, so far back in the night of the past. Down here at the beginning, that painful thing was already stirring, the seed of sorrow and of so much delight.
Wow. It's just beautiful.
It is. It stirs up so much in me. And of course, she's setting, you know, this is where she kind of decides that she's going to do something with her art and her life. And that, that she talks later about how kind of, being around the dwellings of these people and their artifacts, she kind of feels a higher calling that there's something more that she needs to do with her life and that she owes it, to those that came before her. It's quite lovely. Now, as she goes off into the world, though, and continues her career, it kind of ends in a way that that surprised me a bit reading it the second time. And I thought, well, how could she have that spiritual connection? And then how could she let her life turn into what it turned into? Because she ends up rather successful, but she seems to have really forgotten who she was, which is not what I would have expected.
Yeah, that's kind of disappointing.
it is a little bit, but there's a blogger and a podcaster, actually, Chris Wolak, who writes at Wild Moo Books. Mm-hmm. And her podcast is Book Cougars or something like that. She does with another friend of hers. And she is a big Cather fan, and this is her favorite book. And so when I finished it and I wasn't feeling as positive about it as I do other Cather books, you know, she and I were just having this rapid fire back and forth on, you know, messaging each other. And it just so makes me want to discuss this with a group. I mean, it's just one of those books that I think it'd be a perfect book club book, maybe more than even some of her others, because there are so many themes that, you know, because they're not perfect, I think it makes it kind of more fun to explore with other people,
right?
Instead of something just being so wrapped up all neat and tight. So that is my first choice, Willa Cap.
Now, I'm kind of surprised at this. I mean, I know these books are grouped together in this trilogy, but it doesn't sound like, cause I know the O Pioneer story pretty well, and I know My Antonia pretty well. It doesn't sound like there are any crossover characters or even the families are different. I wonder, did she group them together or have they just been grouped later on?
No, I think it was later on. People just trying to drew those two, three together. They were published one after the other. They did all, you know, take place somewhere on the plains.
Yeah.
And so I think it was just, it's a geographic thing more than anything. Although of course that geography is inherent in what she's writing as well.
Yeah.
But no, it's not a trilogy by any means. So you shouldn't feel, no one should feel that they need to start in any place on these. It's wherever.
That's good to know, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, another thing about Cather and her 12 novels, she wrote another one later in, I forget, towards the end, I think, called Shadows on the Rock. And it's almost like Little House on the Prairie goes to colonial Quebec. Because wow. it reads a bit like a juvenile novel, but in the most wonderful, fantastic, you know, fun way. And it takes place in like the 1600s in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And it's told, I think the main character is maybe a 12 or 13 year old girl. And that one's, and that's one that to me, who thought I knew Cather when I came across that one, I was like, what? Where? How have I never heard of this?
Yeah, I didn't know that title at all. Well, thank you so much. That sounds really good. I definitely need to read that one.
Thank you for listening.
Of course. Happened to, for my first book, I decided to try reading a book by one of your favorite authors. So I did Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner. And this actually won the Booker Prize, I think, yes. In 1980 something.
1984.
You just know that off the top of your head. That's how much you love her.
It is.
And I've never read anything by this author before, but I'm going to tell you the exact moment that she had me. It's on page, well, it's really page 3, but it says page 9 because you know how books are numbered. Turning her back on the toneless expanse beyond the window, she contemplated the room, which was the color of overcooked veal, veal-colored carpet and curtains, high narrow bed with veal-colored counterpane, small austere table with a correct chair placed tightly underneath it, a narrow, costive wardrobe, and at a very great height above her head, a tiny brass chandelier, which she knew would eventually twinkle drearily with 8 weak bulbs. I feel like this whole book has so much humor in it, but if you read it the wrong way, you would miss it entirely.
Yes. Well, and you know, I first read her when I was in my 20s, and a lot of that kind of went over my head, and I just saw them as being veal colored books, you know?
Yeah.
Because they are kind of, in some ways, they could feel monotone if you're not really tuned into what she's writing.
And I'm just going to read one other line as an example, and then I'll just talk about the book. But
cool.
This one, I think I had to stop and laugh for a while on this one. The company of their own sex, Edith reflected, was what drove many women into marriage. So, yeah. I don't know what I would have thought of this book when I was younger, but as someone, you know, in relationships now and as an adult, it definitely, I feel like it kind of resonated with me a little bit. You have this poor author, Edith Hope, and she's basically been banished from her house for a while because she's committed, all you know in the beginning is she's committed some major societal faux pas. You don't necessarily know what they are, although you get hints of it at the beginning. And she goes to this hotel where I thought it was winter because she describes it as being gray and dreary, but you find out later it's actually summer. It's almost the off season, but it's still like it's bright and sunny, and her life just isn't bright and sunny. So I think it's really interesting because she really captures how Edith is feeling. And at first, you really just get to know the characters of the hotel through Edith's eyes. And of course, Edith is a writer, so she's pretty observant. And she is making guesses about people that don't always end up being true. And she gets to know them better. And you really get this very clear picture. Like, there's this one woman and her daughter. And the woman is beautiful and perfectly dressed. And she seems vibrant and young. And then there's this moment where she stands up and her body is weak and her muscles are weak, and you realize, oh, she's actually elderly. And just little moments like that I thought were really memorable. And then you start finding out what happened. And I don't know that I should necessarily give it away, although the book is 30 years old. So she definitely was involved with a man that she shouldn't have been, you know, in societal rules. Well, she gets involved with a man at the hotel, and I loved that relationship because he's very direct with her. He's very observant too, and he's made all these assumptions about her. And it seems like they're going to run off into the sunset together, but there's this moment where Edith has this great self-possession and she realizes something very important, and she just says, nope. I don't know. There's something about it that reminded me of what I love about Jane Austen. It's not the same in tone at all, but something about the way the women are written and the how some people are shallow and just spend money. And then the central characters that you're supposed to empathize with are maybe not so attractive and rich, but maybe they're smarter. So that's what I take from this book.
Well, and I think that Hotel du Lac, because of its kind of cast of characters that come through the hotel, that are staying at the hotel, I think it might be more Jane Austen-like than some of the others. I mean, there's the observation, there's mm-hmm. the kind of novel of manners, that kind of stuff. But this one, with its cast of characters, it really, you do start to think of some of those smaller characters in Austen who kind of come in and are just such archetypes of who they are, and they're funny and they're sad and they're all these things. And she really does have them all staying at the Hotel du Lac, doesn't she?
Yeah.
So Bruckner wrote 24 novels. And to make it even more interesting, she started in 1980, roughly, when she was 50. She was an art history professor and had written, art history books, but she'd never written a novel. So between 1980 or so, and I forget when she published her last one, she pretty much wrote a book a year and wrote 24 of them. But so I've read all 24. I'm up to number 11 of rereading them all in chronological order.
Good for you.
And
well, if this one's kind of different with a cast of characters, what is more typical of her?
Well, they always do have characters that she so finely depicts, none of her books are big. They're like just over 200 pages roughly.
Which is perfect, I think.
It is. But she says so much so well in that period that just worlds of things happen. And even within a sentence, it's amazing how she can pack in so much into one sentence. And I don't mean plot stuff. I just mean so much observation, so many kind of comments on life and the way people might be feeling. Mm-hmm. So there's always those characters. But this one, I think because they are at this hotel and it's almost like a vignette or like something you might watch on the stage.
Yeah.
Whereas in most of the other books, it's more part of their kind of everyday life. And there's a little more kind of that, the mundane quality of just people living their lives. It's less of a stage kind of, but no, they're always there. They're just now the first several of her books that I read, I found them very depressing. And a lot of people find them that way because they can seem bleak. And, when she talks about that veal colored room, there's a lot of veal colored rooms in her books, and there's a lot of people just kind of sitting around waiting to die.
Yeah.
So it can be an acquired taste. And I always used to read them as kind of, cautionary tales. Like if you're not careful, if you don't kind of grab life and get what you want out of it, that could be you just sitting around eating some tinned peaches, waiting to go to bed at 8 o'clock at night. But there is that quality. And so in some ways, Edith in this book, she's much kind of more glamorous and worldly than most of her main characters. There's always kind of some glamorous bit in the book, but it's not always the main character. And here it kind of is.
She's not necessarily like the best dresser, but she has a successful writing career.
Right, exactly.
So yep. She's, independent, which is unique.
Yes. And I think, isn't it Mrs. Pierce who's the kind of glamorous one with the glamorous daughter?
Is that how you pronounce it?
I think that just popped into my head. If I'm not even sure if that name is correct.
No, it has a Y at the end, so I didn't know how to say it.
Pusey. I think it's Pusey. Yeah.
Okay.
There's more sex going on in these books than I thought the first time I read them, because it's just not explicit. It's kind of implied in most cases. And it does make them more kind of subversive, I think, than I thought the first time around.
Right. Especially if it's the women that are having it.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. But Bruckner was an odd duck. She passed away last year and she remained unmarried her whole life. And she was a smoker and I think a scotch drinker. And I think throughout her books, I think she almost has an affinity for men.
Yeah.
But she was kind of a feminist, but not in a way that she would have ever pegged as a feminist. And I think a lot of people who read it from a feminist angle think that she's drawn these really old fashioned women who cleave to all these social mores that are kind of anti-feminist. But I think that's just a shallow reading of all of her characters.
It's the world they're forced into rather than the
one absolutely.
They want,
absolutely.
Like. Well, okay. Yeah. So if not this one, which of the other 23 is your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
Well, two come to mind. One, people have asked me which one should I start with, and Hotel du Lac is not a bad one to start with. But I think there's another one that almost has a real plot to it, mm-hmm. and that's Lewis Percy. It also has a male as a main character, but I think that's a good kind of one if you just want to test the waters. But I think one of my favorites, and now I'm not even going to remember the title. It might be her first novel, where her main character is studying the book Adolf by Benjamin Kant. Providence, I think. So there's Benjamin. I wish I could remember the author's name. When Melville House did their Art of the Novella series, mm-hmm. one of the novellas they had was, I think it's called Adolf, and it's by Benjamin Constant or something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, I had read Providence previously, and I think that's the book this happens in, where the person in the book is kind of studying that text. Well, when I reread it the second time, I had recently read this novella that the character is studying. So to have just read the source material, and the thing to remember about Anita Bruckner, she was an art history professor. She clearly spoke French, which you notice all her books have some element of French in them.
But she doesn't translate.
Exactly. which nowadays, of course, that's not too big of a deal. But when I was, 25 reading it, it was a little tougher. Yeah. But and all of her characters are generally well off, not necessarily rich, but they never have to worry about money. Mm-hmm. They tend to live in London with occasional jaunts into France. And anyway, I could talk about her all day, so I'll stop.
Well, I have a few more written down because I feel like I really liked this one, so I might as well try some more.
Well, and the good thing is they're really easy to find at used bookstores.
Yeah, I got this one for $1. It's in perfect shape.
Yep.
Well, what about your second book you want to talk about?
My second book is called Ben in the World by Doris Lessing. And this one technically is a sequel to a book of hers called The Fifth Child. I would say that you don't need to read the first one to read Ben in the World, but you probably will enjoy Ben in the World, or you'd be more enlightened by it if you do. Hmm. So The Fifth Child was this woman who has four children, and she's pregnant with her fifth, and they have this very warm, open, welcoming house where they always have lots of guests for dinner, and the children are interactive with everyone, and it's a really positive kind of thing. But during her fifth pregnancy, she starts to have all sorts of, it's a troubled pregnancy. The child just seems to be like beating her up from the inside. Hmm. And I tell women of fertile age maybe not to read that book because it is a little, it's almost like a horror story in a way. Anyway, she has the child and then the child is a bit troubled as well. And, it was written in the 1970s. And so as I was reading it, I was thinking, well, this sounds like a child who's on the autism spectrum.
Hmm.
But just greatly misunderstood and no one knows how to kind of handle this child. And it's a brilliant book and sad and all that kind of stuff. So I was at a used bookstore and I stumbled across this book and Ben in the World. So it's that child who's now 17 years old. At least some of the flashbacks kind of go back. Well, I guess he's 18 when the book opens. And he still has challenges in the world for sure. But what's interesting is in The Fifth Child, he could just have been this person with some sort of developmental difference. But in this book, it takes on an almost fairy tale-like quality. And I kind of mean that in like the Grimm's fairy tale kind of way.
Yeah.
Because she really seems to go for it when she kind of describes his being and turns him into a bit of a monster. And I don't mean that I don't think he's a monstrous person, but the way that he's described and seen by others is as a bit of a monster. And there's probably no better way to kind of convey that than to give you a sense of, So as the book opens, he's 18. He's essentially been, you kind of gather as the pages go by that he's been kind of kicked out of his home life for whatever reason. And there's an elderly woman who saw him out in public having trouble, I think at the supermarket. And so she takes him home and takes care of him. And although he's 18, he looks more to be like in his 30s or 40s. And so she's this old woman on a pension, but she, you know, sees something in him that she thinks needs nurturing. So she takes him home. And this is a scene where she's giving him a bath because he doesn't really know how to kind of take care of himself. Under her hands was a strong, broad back with fringes of brown hair on either side of the backbone, and on the shoulders a mat of wet fur. It felt like that, as if she was washing a dog. On the upper arms there was hair, but not so much, not more than could be on an ordinary man. His chest was hairy, but it wasn't like fur, it was a man's chest. She handed him the soap, but he let it slide into the water and dug around furiously for it. She found it and lathered him vigorously, and then used a little hand shower to get it all off. He bounded out of the bath, and she made him go back, and she washed his thighs, his backside, and then his genitals. He had no self-consciousness about these, and so she didn't either. And then he could get out, which he did, laughing and shaking himself into the towel she held. She enjoyed hearing him laugh. It was like a bark. Long ago, she had a dog who barked like that. She dried him all over and led him back to the room naked and made him put on his new underpants, his new vest, a charity shop shirt, his trousers. Then she put a towel around his shoulders and as he began to jerk about in protest. She said, "Yes, Ben, you have to." She trimmed his beard first. It was stiff and bristly, but she was able to make a good job of it. And now his hair, and that was a different matter, for it was coarse and thick. The trouble was his double crown from which, if cut short, showed like stubbly whorls on the scalp. It was a necessity that she had left the hair on the top of his head long and on the sides. And then she, it just kind of goes on from there. And then later she talks about how, you know, he'll watch TV with her, but he prefers wildlife programs. and then there are other scenes where, and this is something that I kind of missed the first time I read this book, but there's where he likes meat and fruit. He doesn't like bread, and he actually will go out at night and find small mammals and birds and eat them. And it's so the first, you know, I had forgotten that there really was this kind of monster like individual, but as the book goes on, he, you know, he's just totally misunderstood. He's totally taken advantage of. Anytime he starts to, you know, get anywhere where he can at least make money to take care of himself, it gets stolen from him. He gets cheated by employers. He's always kind of in trouble through kind of no fault of his own. Now, I don't know how you felt about A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. I don't want to get onto my soapbox about that book because
wasn't
I did not.
Your thing.
Exactly. But so this is a book that's, now granted, Doris Lessing won the Nobel Prize for Literature, so maybe we shouldn't compare people to her. But this book is about 180 pages. And she kind of, to me, conveys the kind of horrible life and loss and all the stuff that was in A Little Life without needing to be graphic and without needing to really go on for 800 pages. And I guess maybe that's, again, the difference between a Nobel winner and regular mortals.
A little brevity.
Yes. What's interesting is he gets in with a biker gang, but then he gets in trouble with them and they beat him up. And then he, a prostitute actually takes him in, and that's kind of okay. But then her boyfriend turns him into a drug mule, to France, and essentially is going to just abandon him there, once he's done the job. But then while he's kind of in the process of being abandoned in this country that, you know, he doesn't speak the language and he has these very limited coping skills, an American filmmaker kind of stumbles across him and decides to take him to Brazil and kind of make a movie about him. Not a documentary, but something kind of more sensational because of his oddity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a little far-fetched, and I'm not one who really likes the far-fetched, but for some reason it works for me in this book. And the funny thing is that as he was, you know, first going from England to France and then from France to Brazil, it reminded me of Frankenstein, the book, in which the monster gets, if I remember correctly, gets from the continent to England. And I'm like, come on, how did he do that? How did it? how come no one saw him on the boat, you know, that kind of stuff. But, and so as he kind of got from place to place, continent to continent, I thought it was kind of similar to that. And I'd be curious to know if Lessing actually meant to do that. But anyway, so it kind of goes on and it gets really dark in places. And one thing that happens consistently, though, is the only people who show him any sort of love or caring, they're all women. And, you know, if we're going to be, if I'm going to paint with a broad brush, I would say, well, that's no big surprise, because that just, you know, fits in with our common notions about who are the carers in the world. Whether or not that's entirely true is a different story. But in this case, they're all women who don't identify with him, but they see that there's a human in there. There's a soul that's hurting and needs help. Mm-hmm. And then all these other people who are just out to get him. And it does not have an uplifting ending. I'm not going to say any more than that. Mm-hmm. But it's just a really chilling, touching book, and really kind of makes you think about a lot of different things, how we treat other people, how we perceive other people. I think as well, this could also be a really good book club book, because for as much as I like it and for as much as I think it's a brilliant book, I think there are a lot of things that you could really argue about in terms of that's just silly, or she's characterizing all of this as this. I mean, you really could have a good, healthy kind of knockdown, drag out discussion, where I think if I hadn't read it a second time, I would have been offended by someone who didn't like it. Like, what? You just don't know what you're talking about. But having read it a second time, I think, you know, I can see now how people could really be annoyed by this book, and for good reason. So, yeah. But it still is a pretty fantastic book.
The one I have at home that I really want to try someday, but I feel like I don't want to read it by myself, like I want to read it with other people, is The Golden Notebook. Have you ever read that one?
I have indeed. And of course, it's her magnum opus. It's like, right. What, 500 pages? The Golden Notebook, it's not where I would start. It's where I started with. No, is it where I started with Lessing? I forget. But I certainly wouldn't start there. Yeah. I think it's a tad bit dated, because a lot of it is kind of 1950s kind of communism in London. Mm. And so many of those issues have played out in ways that just don't make that story. It's still interesting, but it's just, you know, communism didn't turn into what some people thought it would turn into.
Yeah, that's true.
Post-wall, it's hard to kind of get in the whole spirit of that. And when there were people who were socialists in Britain who wanted a better life for people, not necessarily a communist, but at any rate, the thing about The Golden Notebook is that it's about five different narratives in one book. And five different types. And when I read it and I reviewed it on my blog, I actually created a graphic to try and explain like what was going on in the book. And it was something like, you know, like there's this notebook that says this, and then there's a notebook within a notebook that has a play within a notebook. It's just like all these different layers of it. And you're just like, wait a minute, which notebook am I in now? And which part? So it is, I would agree with you that reading that with a group and with people to kind of cheer you on and help explain things along the way would be the way to do that. But otherwise, just choose one of our other books, because they're much more accessible. The Grass is Singing, I think, is a great one. Mm. And she's got some great short stories, and so lots of, but if you start with The Golden Notebook, you might think this is an author not for me. Right. But if you start with some of her others, and there's so many of hers that I haven't read.
Yeah, I'm just looking through this list, like so many of these I've not heard of. Well, I guess I'll move on to my second one.
Oh, of course.
Okay. One of my reading projects for this year is my Borders project, where I'm trying to read narratives from places that don't officially exist on a map, or people who are refugees, things like that. And so that was my goal before the year even started. And then the travel ban happened.
Yep.
And then it became also, I want to read books from those seven places too, just because. And so this book kind of fits both of those things. And it's about Aleppo. It's called No Knives in the Kitchens of the City by Khaled Khalifa. And it came out in Syria in 2016 in Arabic, 2013. And it was translated into English in 2016. So it's very recent. And it talks about Aleppo through the lens of one family, kind of between the years of 1963 or 66 through 2000. So it's not up to the present day, but in the 60s, Aleppo was a very society-based city, lots of arts and music and fashion and a lot of different types of people. And when one more revolution happened, I think it's when the current Assad's father took power in the late 60s, it slowly started to be turned into a country suffering from civil war, from extremism, militias and violence. And so the novel is very much about the loss of what Aleppo used to be. And it's definitely, I don't think there's a happy moment in the entire thing. It was hard to read, I have to say. And there's a line, something about cities die just like people. So that's kind of the sense. And I'm not even going to explain the title to you because it's kind of a horrific moment in the novel, actually. It starts off with the mother having died, and it moves back and forth in time. And really a lot of the novel is about the mother, because she is the one that reveled in the beauty of the society part of the city. You know, she had all these friends and connections and she just loved it. And so she's mourning the loss of it throughout the novel. And then the narrator is unnamed. You might guess it might be Khaled Khalifa. And then he has one sister who died young, who was had some kind of either mental or physical handicap. You don't really know a lot about it. It's kind of like the family shame, in other words. One sister who, shall we say, embraces life. She joins a militia in one part. She wears short skirts and has a very interesting life for part of it. She just kind of embraces whatever she's into. And then there's the brother who is a musician. And then, of course, music becomes less and less important. And so his identity gets called into question. But then there's also the characters of the mother, who, of course, is central, and her brother, who is openly gay, which I was surprised about, honestly. A lot of novels that come from the Arabic-speaking world, you don't see a lot of LGBT characters.
No.
Not a typical thing, although, you know, I know of a few. It's happening more recently, like in the last 5 to 10 years, but not a lot before then. And so it's very interesting to read about it in within this context of the city changing and the rules changing. And he spends a lot of time in jail in the context of this because, you know, the religious changes are making his life harder for sure. I'll just read something that the mother says on the first page. How about that? "Power and oppression do not die, my mother would say. The blood of his victims won't allow the tyrant to just die. The door has been left ajar and will keep closing until it chokes their murderer." So there's this interesting storyline where several times it's announced that the dictator has died, and you find out that it's a test to see who's mourning him, who's celebrating. And so no one can believe anything because everything is all about where your loyalties are.
That's so insidious. Can you imagine that they're doing that just to see how people respond? That's so awful.
I know.
I didn't recognize the title of the book until you mentioned Aleppo and the travel ban, because I have this book. I tried to get a book from each of the banned countries, and I think I came up one or two short. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have this one. So I'm excited now to take a look at it, because I think, you know, it's so easy for those of us who don't pay attention to what culture's like in the Middle East to realize that, you know, this isn't just some patch of dust with a hut. You know, this is like, it was a really cosmopolitan kind of place. And when you see the pictures before the bombings and after, it's just devastating.
Heartbreaking. It's funny because in my in-person book club, we read a book about the Armenian genocide, because we're all about cheer. But Aleppo is one of the places that people ended up from Armenia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
So you have these people who are refugees three times over, basically. But, you know, so that culture is very present. There's a lot of Turkish influence, a lot of even French influence. Yeah, so there's all this vibrant culture going on that gets kind of just dusted over. It's crazy. But it felt like almost like a moment of silence or something to read it. Like it felt really important to read it. So I'm glad that you're doing that.
You know, I read so much kind of cozy British stuff that I like to read about other places that are just literally foreign to my experience. I've always find that fascinating, especially people sitting in cafes drinking whatever the local alcohol is, which is so not me, but I like the idea of it. Did you ever read Half a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Adichie Ngozi Adichie?
No, but it's on my list, and I think I even have it at home. I've read her later stuff, but not her earlier stuff.
It's a fantastic book, but like you described this one, it's brutal to read. There's not a lot of fun, and there's just like atrocity after atrocity that people like us who have never come close to experiencing anything like that just cannot even imagine what that life would be like.
You know, I spent last year reading Africa. I was trying to finish reading a book from every country, didn't make it, but
wow. That's a lot of countries.
Yeah, it really is. And I feel like it grew because by the time I got to the end of the year, I felt like I wasn't any farther than I'd been.
Right.
But I mean, so many stories about loss of home, loss of self, loss of family. It was very hard. And I guess maybe we should feel lucky that that isn't our everyday.
Yes. But you think? Yeah.
It's important to know about. It's important to understand. But
yes.
Maybe not, you know, one book after another for your own sanity. Well, okay. How about your book number three?
My book number three is called The Dark Flood Rises by Margaret Drabble, another British author. And if I'm not mistaken, she is A.S. Byatt's sister.
Hmm.
And if I'm not mistaken, they don't speak.
Oh, really?
And if I'm not mistaken, I've never read any A.S. Byatt because I saw the movie version of Possession and hated it so much that I couldn't imagine reading the book. But anyway, so Margaret Drabble, I tend to like her more recent stuff. This one was actually published this year, I think. It was 2016, we're in 2017. Well, it was a hardcover. It was on the new bookshelf at the bookstore. So for me, that's about as new as they get.
Yeah.
And I do really like her in general. She's a great writer. And so, of course, I picked it up without even thinking twice. And so essentially, The Dark Flood Rises is essentially about death or getting old and dying. And you know, that's a theme that I don't mind. I actually oddly take comfort in it. I have a lot of favorite books that are kind of about old people near death, and Anita Bruckner, it seems like everyone's near death. And but as I read this, I thought, you know what? Maybe I'm reading too much about this stuff, because one day I'm going to be there and I'm going to think, why in the heck did you spend all that time reading about this when you could have been, if not doing something, you could have been reading about something less depressing. So I may reassess my reading habits after reading this, but she takes the title from D.H. Lawrence from The Ship of Death: piecemeal the body dies and the timid soul has her footing washed away as the dark flood rises. Mm-hmm. And so the main character, her name is Fran, and she's in her 70s. She loves what she does. She essentially goes around the country and kind of inspects and accommodations for elderly people, not in a I'm from the government kind of inspection, but she works for a nonprofit that is looking to have positive impact on elderly policies and funding and that kind of stuff. So she loves what she does, and she, you know, seems like a very active, happy person, and for the most part she is, but she's in her 70s, and so she's getting older, and her, you know, her age cohort's getting older, and her ex-husband's getting older, and all these other things. And so there's just a lot of people getting older. And then her son lost a girlfriend. She died unexpectedly. And so there's a lot of death in it. But the thing about it is, Fran's the main character, but then there's lots of other characters that we get to know pretty well. And I love a book that has you know, that kind of cast of characters where you get to see a lot of different stories that sometimes kind of twine together and sometimes don't. But her daughter, Poppet is her name, P-O-P-P-E-T, in the end turns out to be a not very well developed part of the book, but there is a great, I'm just going to read a little bit about her or the way that she's described, because I think it shows Drabble's kind of sense of humor and in this particular book and the way she kind of characterizes people. Poppet Stubbs is in her 40s, but she is not very young. Her blood is not young. She takes after her mother in a certain wiriness of energy, in a physique combining thin shoulders and strong legs, and she also has her mother's doggedness of purpose. Her brother Christopher has his father's more fleshly nonchalance, and like his father is something of a bon viveur. But Poppet is austere, and it is considered that she wishes to impose austerity on others. Within the family, she can influence her mother, who, as a woman, is accessible to guilt. Also, born under wartime rationing, Fran is keen on small savings, but Claude and Christopher do not care about thrift. All of them drink too much, she thinks. Poppet drinks very little. She has witnessed too much drinking. She is of the view that alcohol is criminally cheap. Fran agrees, as a citizen and as a person who can afford to get drunk in a premier inn or at home in her tower whenever she wants, but she always sees the other side of the argument. She sees from the perspective of poverty and would not wish to deprive the deprived. Poppet is ideologically austere and gives no quarter. She doesn't care much for the present, but she cares about the future of the planet and its inhabitants. She has transferred her allegiance to a vanishingly distant point. She has what some of her friends and acquaintances consider an almost mystic capacity to personalize the planet and dehumanize her own concerns. Maybe they think she has no concerns. She does not seem very concerned about any of her friends, and it is hard for them to stay close to her, although some loyally and on the whole thanklessly continue to insist on maintaining a relationship with her. Cold though she is also compelling. She's worth one's while. Poppet is also physically strong in a muscular sense, but she is also neurologically hypersensitive to pollution. Plastic bags, bad air, bad noise levels, overflying aircraft, the humming of air conditioning, Muzak, artificial flavorings. She is sensitive to orange, yellow, red, and carmazine. And it goes on. And I'll just end with this last little bit. Poppet's house is much less eccentric than that. It's a standard 19th century farm laborer's brick and board cottage, inhabited in early years by crowding families, but now her own domain, where she lives alone, old maidish, spinsterly, and secure. But the thing is, we don't hear too much about Poppet in the rest of the book, but each of the characters that kind of comes through gets that same kind of treatment, where you just learn a lot about them and their foibles and how they fit in with everything. And I enjoyed it. And the other thing that Drabble does is, in probably all of her books, is she weaves in so much history, sociology, archaeology, anthropology, geology. You know, she weaves that stuff in a way that never feels like she's telling us anything. It's just part of the character's personalities that we hear about these things. And I love that kind of reading, and I hate it when authors are bad at it. Yeah. And you feel like they're just trying to show you how much they know. And I think that Margaret Drabble does it well. Penelope Lively does it really well. And there are all these authors who really know how to. And also the book Euphoria by Lily King. Have you read that fairly recent? Gosh,
I love that.
Yeah, so I love that kind of book that kind of takes you back to school without making you feel like you're in school.
You know what I did after I read Euphoria, though, is I went and read, oh, who is the anthropologist that's based on?
Oh, is it Margaret Mead? Or is it Ruth Benedict?
It's Margaret Mead. And I went back and read her two early books, which are not as interesting as Euphoria. I mean, they're fine, but they're really just ethnographies and can be a little dry.
Yes.
No romance.
No.
So you have to really kind of give it to authors that can make it so readable.
Yes. Well, that's those who learn how to write and those who are writers, I guess. Mm-hmm.
they're
what is your third book?
This is a memoir. This is called The Outrun by Amy Liptrot. It is a first book, and it actually won the Wainwright Prize in the UK for 2016. And the Wainwright Prize is about nature writing. But this is also an alcohol memoir, which is not my favorite thing. But the book itself is amazing. So Amy Liptrot grew up in the Orkneys. And after a decade of basically destroying her body and her life by being an alcoholic in London in her 20s, she enters a rehab center for 3 months and then returns home to the Orkney Islands because she can't afford to live. She doesn't have a job or any income anymore. And it's kind of about how being back in this place, which is such a very specific landscape, and working with nature, working with birds, and she moves around on the Orkney Islands because she's counting these birds that only come out at night. How it just, it kind of revitalizes her and kind of brings her back to herself. It's a very healing thing. But what I really love about the book is the nature writing, because I have this obsession with cold weather islands, and the Orkneys are on my list of places I want to go someday. And so much of it is just descriptions of these bleak places that I find so beautiful. So I'm just going to read a little bit of one as an example. This is really near the beginning. The wind in Orkney is almost constant. At the farm, the westerly gales are the worst, bringing the sea with them, and tons of rock can be moved overnight, the map altered in the morning. Easterlies can be the most beautiful, when the wind blows toward the tide and skims a glittering canopy of spray from the top of the waves, catching the sun. The old croft houses are squat and firm, like many Orcadian people, built to survive the strongest gales. That sturdy balance has not been bred into me. I am tall and gangly. Following the familiar coast, I'm trying not to feel unstable. It's been more than a decade since I lived here, and memories from my childhood are merging with more recent events, the things that brought me back to Orkney. As I struggle to open a wire gate, I remember what I repeated to my attacker. I am stronger than you. At the end of a winter, the land is brown and washed out, and the outrun seems barren, but I know its secrets. So...
I'm smiling as you read that, because I also like kind of barren places devoid of people and with nature and all that kind of thing, which wasn't me as a kid, but as an adult it is. And I'm not sure why that came about with me, but that sounds lovely.
It's amazing. And there's one little part of it where she goes to one of the most northern islands, and she gets involved with these old people that have lived there forever that have a swimming club. So every Sunday they go swimming in the ocean, which, you know, has got to be below freezing. And just like people like that and characters like that, the people that have just been there for generations and probably have all this Norse bloodline in them. Oh, so good.
You know, as you were talking about that, it makes me think of there's a book, I think it's, Bernard McLaverty is an author who was shortlisted for the Booker back in the 90s, or maybe shortlisted. And I think it was his book, Grace Notes, the one that was shortlisted. I think there's that character goes off and I think lives on an island off of Scotland. She's a composer, I think.
Oh my gosh, that's like two things that I have to read. I love novels with music and The Cold Weather Islands. Bernard McLaverty?
McLaverty. McLaverty. Grace Notes.
Wow, I've never heard of that.
Yeah. I quite like it. I reread it recently, and it wasn't a blip. I did like it for a reason. But she's, I think, postpartum, maybe, depression, but she's a composer and living, you know, if it's not an island, it's definitely on a windswept Scottish coast, if I'm not mistaken.
It still counts.
Yeah. If I had known you liked books about music, because that's one of my quests, is to find books that write intelligently about music. Because so often I feel, especially gay male authors, they get very name droppy
Did you read Orfeo by Richard Powers?
No.
Is that his name? Richard?
Could be.
It was shortlisted or longlisted for the Booker. Yeah, Richard Powers. It's about a composer who gets arrested and accused of being a terrorist. I don't know. I really liked it.
And you know, you might like the Song of the Lark for the musical bits in it too, because she goes into all sorts of discussions about the music she's studying and various composers and whatever. But two of my favorite books that include music, one is called The Student Conductor by, oh, it might be Richard Ford. Is that what you just said? No, Robert. No. What is his name? The Student Conductor. It's a great book. The guy, he's a playwright and teaches somewhere in the South, and he's only written that one novel. And I actually wrote him a fan letter one day saying, write another book.
Robert Ford.
Yeah. And then another one that's brilliant, brilliant, is called The Song of Names by Norman LeBrecht.
Oh my gosh, I don't know either of these.
Oh, do you ever listen to audiobooks?
Uh-huh.
So The Song of Names is probably the best audiobook I've listened to. The narrator is outstanding. So I already liked the book and had read it once or twice. And then I listened to the audio version of it, and it's so well done. And so Norman LeBrecht is a classical music critic in England, and he can be very bitchy and snarky. His Twitter feed's almost too hard to follow because he's just so snarky about everything. But he's written two good novels, really good. And this one, The Song of Names, has a real strong musical element to it. That's really amazing. But we'll have to share further notes on this in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm always looking for that as a theme. Well, are you reading anything now or anything that you're excited about next?
Well, I literally just finished the Margaret Drabble today. Talk about cramming for finals. So I can't even really say that I'm reading anything now. And then, you know, I have a stack of things next to my bed, but I don't remember what's in it. And so we're into April now. So I need to read my fourth Willa Cather, and month it'll be my Antonia. So I'll be picking that up soon, because I don't like to leave it too late in the month, because then I feel like I'm under pressure. Mm. But you know, I just recently reorganized my library, so I have reacquainted myself with all the hundreds of books that I haven't read. And so they're all kind of exciting to me right now.
Right. Well, did you do any creative categories, or do you just do alphabetically?
I do alphabetically by author's last name, and I interfile or intershelve all of my unread books with my read books.
Uh-huh.
Some people
makes it easier to find, I think
I'm bananas.
Yeah.
But what are you reading right now?
Well, I was trying to think, you know, it's National Poetry Month, and so this month I'm trying to read an entire book of poetry every day of the month. Not a deep read, obviously, because poetry really takes quite a bit of time. I've been finding some good stuff, so I'm going to try to keep doing that. I have kind of a backlog of review copies and a backlog of books at home that I hadn't read, so that'll be good. And then I found out that newly crowned Pulitzer Prize winner Matthew Desmond, who won for the Nonfiction Award, is going to be on my campus on Wednesday. So I have a copy of his book Evicted that one of my Goodreads friends sent me. So I'm thinking maybe I need to move that up the list. Thank you so much for being on Reading Envy. I really appreciate it.
And thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the depth to which you go on your podcast. And I actually really enjoyed stopping and forcing myself to actually take some notes, something that I don't normally do, because it definitely made me get more out of each of the books. So that was great.
Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode, at readingenvy.com.